GPS is a great example of spatial computing, right? You are using this technology that is using satellites that is bringing information to you directly, right? And so I think that we don't think about how much we're using this stuff on a daily basis and that how much potential it has to help serve us, for example, with, you know, using that technology to go to dangerous places, but also using it for things like surgery, right? And for physical therapies to help people regain strength or help them, you know, with occupational therapy. There's so many opportunities, and that's what excites me about this whole world.
Welcome to Design By, the podcast that celebrates the stars in esteemed science, technology, engineering, arts, math, and design. Regine Gilbert is a true pioneer in the field of spatial computing, inclusive design, and accessibility. Her unwavering dedication to creating digital experiences that are accessible to all individuals, regardless of their abilities, has made a profound impact on industry. Through her work, Regine has not only raised the awareness about the importance of inclusive design and spatial computing, but she's also been instrumental in advocating for its implementation across various industries. Regine, we are so honored to have you on the show today. Let's begin where your journey begins in space and time.
I was born in Inglewood, California, and raised in Watts when I was in my younger age. And then I grew up in Oxnard, California. And I went to, you know, I went to high school with thoughts of going to college. And this was a big thing in my family. My parents didn't let me work because they wanted me to focus on school. And I started out my college journey at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and I was a biology major of all things. And then I ended up transferring to Arizona State. And at Arizona State, I studied communication with no S. I studied human behavior, specifically organizational and intercultural communication. And then I also had a minor in international business. So that was my undergrad, and it kind of took me from California to Nevada to Arizona. And after I finished my undergrad, I went on to grad school, and I went to University of Phoenix, and I got a master's in marketing. Okay. And then I decided to follow my dreams, which was to be a fashion designer. And I applied to Parsons and got in. And in 2005, I moved to New York to study fashion design. And I studied at Parsons for a year, and then I dropped out because it was expensive. And I ended up getting a job as a technical fashion designer. And wow. I did that for 2 years. And it was great until it wasn't. And I wanted something a little bit different. And my friend said, why don't you come work on our team? You're really good at the systems within the same company I was working at. So I said, okay, you know, why not? So I interviewed for a job for an IT trainer, which could not be further from a technical fashion designer. So I interviewed for an IT trainer. I got the job and I was an IT trainer for about 6 months before I moved into a business analyst role within IT. And then from a business analyst role, I got into project management. And then from project management, I got into product management. And it was during my time as a product manager that I wasn't really liking what I was doing. And I started taking courses because one of the things the professor told me a long time ago was to never stop learning. If you always want to keep a job, you have to keep your skills fresh. And so I started taking different courses because I did work, although I worked in IT, I did not work on, you know, I wasn't working on the web. I was working on supply chain systems behind the scenes in the fashion industry. And so I said, I want to take something with the web. And NYU had these continuing, you know, professional studies courses. So I ended up taking like a class to build a website in 3 weekends, right? You know, I was working in Dreamweaver and, and learning basic HTML and CSS and JavaScript. So that's kind of where I started. And eventually I ended up taking a course in user experience design that changed my life in so many ways, from the people that I met in the course to the trajectory of my career, from leaving product management to going into UX to my evolution into becoming a person who focuses on accessibility within UX. So that in a nutshell is kind of my story, I guess. Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that I have loved about following your career is that not only are you a designer, you're an author, right? To me, I think a big part of what I love about what I have followed is that you're an author, and I think that you're doing this remarkable job of building community in the areas of inclusive design, right? But yeah. Also human spatial computing, which is not necessarily emerging, but people, I think that not enough people know about it. And the growing importance of it as we, I think we are of one mind probably believing that it's interesting that we are wearing more technology than we've ever done. We are in this place of, and in the midst of a place of human machine integration in ways that I don't think that we've ever really, people, well, what is human machine integration? I said, well, today you wear a computer on your wrist, right? And you've got usually two computers inside of your ears. That's a sensory organ. You are augmenting, and we have AIs in them, and now we're augmenting our intelligence in ways that, and the spatial computing piece, to your point around supply chain, in a world where I think the lines between virtual and physical worlds are completely and should be blurry, because the tools that we utilize in a virtual sense can help us work on things like supply chains at scale. Right. By creating simulations and doing in simulations of how humans work in space and time. I think that's kind of one of them, right? But the other part is like the ability to, from a virtual place, control major parts. And a great example of this I recently saw was where AR and VR were being used. Our VR headset was actually being used by an oil company to actually maneuver drilling in certain aspects of the ocean. Like, there's a whole conversation of what we should be doing environmentally there, but the technology is such that it's actually enabling people to be more precise in places where you don't have to send where it's really dangerous to send humans to.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, I think what people don't, and people may not know what spatial computing is. If you've ever used a map, right? Let's take that as an example. So if you use Google Maps, or you're using something, you're driving, you use GPS. GPS is a great example of spatial computing, right? You are using this technology that is using satellites, that is bringing information to you directly, right? And so I think that we don't think about how much we're using this stuff on a daily basis, and that how much potential it has to help service, for example, with using that technology to go to dangerous places, but also using it for things like surgery, right? And right. For physical therapies to help people regain strength, or help them, you know, with occupational therapy. There's so many opportunities, and that's what excites me about this whole world.
Right. It isn't complete. I've always believed that design, what makes design, or at least great design, different than just being creative, right, is that there is a scientific, you know, usually you're working against a hypothesis or a problem space that you have to create a hypothesis. There's a tremendous amount of research in there. And there's also technical aspects that have to be considered as in terms of limitations. Have you found that sometimes that sciences, that the, you know, the more traditional sciences has helped inform your way of approaching design?
Yeah, I think yes, to answer your question. And one of the things that I do teach in my user experience design classes is for students to get to the root cause of why something might be happening, why a problem might be occurring. Because even a lot of people don't ever get to the root cause of things and they just design stuff, but they don't know why they're designing it. And yes, you've made something look pretty, but why? You know, why have you done that? I think it's really important to understand the root cause, and that is part of scientific findings, right? To understand what is happening and why it's happening to begin with, which could be layered. You know, it could be a layered issue. Maybe sometimes you can do something about it, sometimes you cannot. But I think it's really important for designers, if you're really wanting to understand people and people's behaviors, getting to that root cause can help you do that, which in essence will make you a better designer.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. In some of that early career, you know, I want to focus kind of on the evolution, right? Because going from product too into, so often I find so many of designers who feel like they've gotten stuck in their design career path for some reason will go into product. But very rarely do I hear product going, hey, you know what? I love this thing that you guys call design, the craft of it, the pursuit of focusing on how it works, right? Versus just how it looks. Tell me a little bit about that journey.
Yeah. So I worked in supply chain. So I worked in the back-end systems, the systems that folks don't tend to think about. I mean, everybody is wearing some clothing on them right now, but you don't think about how that clothing actually got to you. And so one of the things that I worked on was a supply chain intelligence tool, which a lot of the back-end systems for fashion. So let's say I'll just walk folks through what happens, right? Yeah. So a designer will come up with some concept, right? And then that concept will go get made in a factory overseas. And that clothing needs to somehow get into a store. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole process, right? So that getting to a store. So in order for it to come here, it's going to come via a boat. Once it gets to, let's say, the United States, it needs to come, you know, it lands on the docks somewhere, typically Los Angeles or somewhere on the East Coast. And then from there, it needs to be put on a truck, right? When it gets put on that truck, then it needs to get taken to a warehouse. All the while, it needs to be tracked the whole time. Once it gets into the warehouse, then it needs all these different items need to get split up and sent to different stores. They can be sent, you know, here in the United States, it could be sent to Canada, who knows where it could be going. So what I worked on was the product that I worked on was a supply chain intelligence tool that a lot of other systems would feed into. And so there was a whole lot of stuff going on with it. And as I was taking my user experience design course, what I found was that a lot of the things user experience designers do, I had already been doing. Looking, you know, doing competitive analysis, doing mock-ups of things, like all these different things. I was like, oh, I've done this. And I didn't feel completely new to it. It's just, I called it different things. When I did a mock-up, I did it in Excel, you know, for example.
It's an interesting thing that even independent of the role that you are in, everybody is a part of the design process. Now, some people might, to your point, use different tools and have slightly different crafts, right? The evolution of the things that you have to do in order to create a user interface or the user experience versus maybe the more strategic aspects of it. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, so when I talk about product, you know, if you're working in technology, your product, you're thinking of an app or a website or whatever it is. When I was working in fashion, our product was the garments, right? Or the handbags or the accessories. And so a lot of folks who have worked in fashion, they go, I want to get into UX, but I don't think I could do it. And I said, but a lot of it is so similar. And I think oftentimes don't see the parallels with what we're doing and how that could translate into what we want to do next. And how I think when folks want to transition into something from something else, they often feel like I lack all these skills. I don't have this. I don't have that. But they never look at what they actually do have and how they can build on that.
I think that's a really good insight. And it's a really interesting time. We're amidst this great global reset. And this is true of business. You know, businesses, even in spite of the pandemic, I think the pandemic in many ways accelerated their transformations into the fourth industrial revolution. And some have figured out, whoa, we're way behind, right? That these traditional models no longer work. And then the other part is that people just reevaluating where they're at and what whether they are happy and getting joy out of the things that they are asked to do every day, right? Do you get joy? I mean, one of the things when I look at your body of work and the things that you've written about, I read joy. There's love there. It's clear there's that these topics bring you joy. And I think so often we don't listen to that signal, or we think that, well, work's not supposed to be joy. For some reason, we've come to this place that somehow that's superfluous and it should be much more transactional. And I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Well, I have a story, actually. So when I was at a point in my career when I was a product manager that I was ready to move on to program management, which is for the folks who don't know, if you're a project has a start and an end, people should know that. And a lot of people will say, well, this project, that's not a project if it's ongoing, right? That's something that needs to be maintained. Yeah, it's a program. So I had interviewed for a program manager role at the company I was working at. And I had interviewed with like the chief operation officer, and they're like, you'd be great for this role. This is such a, you know, the business likes you, the technology side likes you, everything was great. And there was one person I interviewed with who would have been I would have directly reported to them, who was just really unpleasant. They were so unpleasant. And I thought to myself, do I really want to work for this person? And I had to say no. And I walked away from a lot of money. But I took some time off. I was in a privileged place where I could take time off and kind of reevaluate, what do I really want in my life? Mm-hmm. This was long before the pandemic, but I made a decision that I want to pursue things that I like. I want to work with people I like, most importantly. Yeah. And I will not work for someone who will treat me in the way that person treated me, just even in the interview.
Right.
And so that was a huge, it actually stressed me out a lot. And my best friend who was working at the same company was like, you're making the right choice. Don't worry. Everything's going to fall into place. And it did take me a while. I had to, you know, I transitioned into a brand new career. I was moving into user experience design. So I did a lot of freelance work, right? I had to build up my portfolio and do all those things. But I will say it was worth it, because making that decision really did change everything for me. And then one day I woke up and I said, I want to make the world a more accessible place. I didn't know what that meant. So, you know, when you go to Google, and so I looked up accessibility in New York City, and I found a meetup, and I got to go to this meetup where I learned about technology and accessibility. And I said, I want more of this in my life. And I recently found a piece of paper where I'd written down that I want to be the person who's talking about accessibility. And I want to do all these the things that I have actually since done in the last 8 years, which has been kind of incredible. So I get really into user experience design and accessibility, and then talking about it. And that talking about it led me to getting a book offer, which I didn't seek. Somebody saw a talk, and that turned into me writing a book.
That is amazing. I think that's great. What was that journey of pivoting from, you know, just talking about it to actually going through the rigor that it takes to sit down and commit chapter by chapter to a book?
Well, it was hard. It was really hard. I mean, to be honest, it was really hard and I didn't do it alone. I mean, I got a lot of feedback from folks within the disability community, within the accessibility community. As I went along, I wasn't, you know, I didn't feel like I was ever doing it by myself. Also, a big thanks to my students, because my students were my inspiration for writing the book, because a lot of them had questions and I sought to find the answers and put them in that book for other people who had the same questions. Because at the time I was teaching at General Assembly, and at General Assembly, I taught many classes and I incorporated accessibility into my classes, but students always had questions throughout. So I did my best to incorporate that all into the book.
Oh, that's amazing. What is it like to go through and close a book deal? Like, talk to our, like, this is one, I think, one of the things I love to do for our listeners is demystify those processes. Tell me about
that. So, I got an email saying, hey, would you be interested in writing a book? And this was from A Press. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to write a book, but I, you know, it's one of those things. I always wanted to write a book, but what about what? And they proposed that I write about inclusive design for a digital world, which was the title of a talk I had given. And I said, okay, well, what are next steps? And they said, well, you need to create an outline. And then we would need to discuss terms, right? In terms of, is there an advance for the book? How much would I get, you know, once the book is sold? Would you like, you know, one of the things that's come afterward is like, do you want the book translated? But it was using AI. And so I said, no, but, so basically I wrote an outline of the book, and then they said, okay, they accepted. I signed the contract. I agreed to their terms. And then I started writing the book in the way that, I wrote a chapter, and then they would edit the chapter and send it back to me. And so it was like, what made it a bit of a challenge for me was like writing on top of writing and going back to rewrite the things that have been edited and then writing and writing. So it took me about a year to actually get it finished. Mm-hmm. And again, I had a lot of help from folks along the way. It wasn't just me, and my students were extremely helpful in the process as well.
Are you passionate about closing the gender gap in the world of technology and design? Introducing designedbyus.org, a game changer in the fight for equality. Did you know the percentage of women in tech roles today is lower than it was in the 80s? It's shocking, but true. Only 26% compared to the 35% back in 1984. Design by Us is on a mission to close the gender gap in tech and design. And they need your help. Their Action Learning Apprenticeships empowers young, diverse students to pursue careers in technology and design. By making a donation to designbyus.org, you can be a part of this vital change. Your contributions will support apprenticeship, boot camps, and resources for aspiring women in these fields. Together, we can level the playing field and give young, diverse people the support they need to learn, work, and constantly grow. Don't wait. Visit designedbyus.org/donate and make a difference. Designed by Us, closing the gender gap in tech and design.
Attention all design enthusiasts. Get ready to fuel your creativity with the Design By series podcast. Join Joanna Pena-Bickley as she and her guests dive deep into the world of design, covering everything from branding and product design to user experience and innovation. With exclusive interviews from leading experts, the Design By series podcast is a must-listen for anyone looking to stay up to date with the latest trends and techniques in design. Seasons 1 and 2 are streaming now on all major podcast platforms. Subscribe today and take your design game to the next level.
You've had a remarkable career. I mean, you really have. And I think you're just getting started. Just getting started. We're still too young to say one of the things I love that
I didn't say I'm working on my second book now, did I?
Not yet. That's what I was going to take us to, which is, it seems like so far, like, to accomplish one, I know you're on your second one.
Yes. So this book I'm co-authoring with Doug Northcook. Doug and I met when I did a design residency through Falling Water. Falling Water is a Frank Lloyd Frank Lloyd Wright home in Pennsylvania. And this particular design residency that I applied to was for folks who work in immersive technologies, AR and VR. And at that point, I had done some user research around augmented reality. I had created a couple of courses for NYU's online program, UX for AR and VR, co-created. And so I applied to this program where you spend 5 days offline and you get to create concepts or whatever it is you're working on, but you're doing it without a computer. Okay. And they gave us activities to do. They gave us readings to do. We were making things like it looked like, you know, like a children's playground, because play is the highest form of research. That's an Albert mm-hmm. Einstein quote. And so Doug and I met during that time. We ended up becoming friends and working together on a course where he used to teach at Chatham University. So we co-created a curriculum for human-centered design course. And then I ended up getting a full-time job offer at New York University as an industry assistant professor. And one of the things that you have to do as a professor is you have to write or get grants. And so I decided to write, and I thought, I want to write a book about AR and VR and accessibility. Mm-hmm. And Doug had ideas about writing about like affordances and the body and things like this. And so we kind of combined our forces and came up with a book that is titled Human Spatial Computing. And this process for the book was different because it wasn't anybody coming to us. We actually put forth a few book proposals to a few publishers. So we got rejects, which was fine, but then we got an offer. And that offer came from Oxford University Press. So this is an academic book that we are working on. And again, the title is Human Spatial Computing, and it is all about the human side of AR and VR. So we're focusing on human-computer interaction, privacy and ethics, storytelling, and affordances and immersive. We're talking about the mind and the body and what could be, you know, in the future. So it's a little bit different. And then this semester, I have a class titled Human Spatial Computing, where we're going to be actually doing some speculative design, some looking at, you know, critical theory, critical pedagogy. So we're going to build things in Unity and Unreal. We're not doing all that. We're going to take a step back and look at what is the real human side of this. And not only from the lens of we're in America, but we're also going to look at this from a different cultures, because that's important. I think one of the things that we've seen, especially with this technology, with AR and VR, when I ask the question to folks, who do you think about when you think of someone using VR? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the response has been, it's a white guy who's in his 20s, able-bodied. And I said, well, why aren't we thinking of a 50-year-old who's non-binary and in a wheelchair? Mm-hmm. And how can we approach designing for these experiences in a way that we're not thinking about the same person every time that's going to use it? How can we start to think differently? And so that's kind of my hope, is that we don't just think about the same person over and over that could be using this technology, that we're thinking about all of us, and not just us in America, thinking about people around the world who may not have access to the same technologies we do. They might just be using a cardboard headset, and that's okay too, right? Yep. And so there's all these different things to consider, and the different use cases around it. You know, more than half of the country does not have high-speed internet, and I mean the United States.
That's right.
And so a lot of this technology is not even as usable as it could be, right? So there's just so much to consider from a human aspect with all of this stuff.
It's really interesting because, you know, so often we used to talk about the digital divide, and I don't think that we understood that there was going to be a really good correlation between the digital divide and an economic divide. And that effectively mm-hmm. Has been, I think, globally, what we have seen is that the opportunity to participate in a new economy, if that new economy is completely digitized, and particularly in the world of spatial computing, right? That we have to think about accessibility in a very different way. I think you touched on culture, but I also, it's one that I was always, something that I would caution folks on, why I was so loved working on Alexa was because a part of that was also low cost, and the accessibility of the expense of a device, much less than what were the parameters that the device could work in terms of the connectivity, right? To your point around high speed, how do you begin to create collective connectivity out of devices in a way that gets you that extra sense of bandwidth that you need? Because with every, you know, it's almost like one of the math problems that I don't think we pay enough attention to is that for everything that we make inaccessible, we are cutting off dollars of economic opportunity in communities all over the world. And so when we assume that it is the highest, maximum, most immersive bandwidth that is required for the usage of a new device, a headset, right? Any of these things, like these are the things that I think in design, often we go, oh, that's a product problem. We'll figure that out. But actually, it's an accessibility problem.
Yeah, it really is. Like, are we, one of the things that I did early with my research around inclusion and accessibility in AR and VR is take a look at the tools that folks use to create experiences. And do those tools cost money? Do you need to know a certain scripting language or programming language in order to, you know, create something? Because a lot of them you do. Yeah. And so what are those barriers to entry for folks? And a lot of times that is the case where, you know, people can't afford something or they don't have the right computer, right? Or they don't know C# or C++ in order to change scripts, because a lot of things in Unity and Unreal, you'll have to go and change the scripts to even make the thing that you want to make.
Yep.
And so what do people really need in order to be involved? Because I would love to see more folks involved in AR and VR and folks that don't look like the people who are doing it now. I want to see more Black and Brown folks in it. This is my dream. And so one of the things that I'm looking forward to this upcoming semester is my students will be collaborating with some students down in Peru to, we're trying to make this happen, to do some collaboration in web VR using Mozilla Hubs. And so the students will be, you know, a lot of the students in Peru, some of them speak English, some of them don't. My students may speak Spanish, some of them don't. And then how can we get messages to each other? How can we collaborate with each other, not speaking the same language, not having the same exact technology or access?
I want to dive a little bit deeper into human spatial computing because it shouldn't be emerging because the government, for what it's worth, VR was utilized for education in the military for years.
Yes.
Simulation is a wonderful way to think about education, skills education, which we have done with our both our trainees in wartime situations, but even in just mechanical, you know, how to deal in different environments and scenario training, right? Kind of, if you are a Star Trek nerd, for those of you who are Star Trek nerds like I am, it's all of the training of the Kobayashi Maru test that you would take you to that. Our government has been doing the equivalent of that kind of testing with our volunteer army for over 25 plus years. And so it's always surprising to me why it's taken so long to commercialize this technology.
I think cost is a big issue with bringing it to the masses. I think, you know, one of the things that we saw over the pandemic was that, you know, Oculus became very popular. People were at home. Oculus came out at a price point that was affordable for not a lot of people, but enough people. And I was one of those people who said, I have to stay home, so I'm going to order an Oculus. And I'd ordered my Oculus to be delivered to Best Buy, and then New York City shut everything down. And it never actually got to Best Buy because Best Buy closed. And then they weren't expecting this onslaught of people wanting the headset. So there was a whole backup of, they were sold out, people had to wait months for them. And what we saw was people really got into it and then they didn't, right? And what we see now is on average people who bought the headsets will use it once a month.
Okay.
And so why is that? Why haven't we advanced? Well, what is the need for this in our day-to-day life, right? What is the value it's actually going to bring? And that I don't think we've seen yet. And therefore, we haven't seen the advancements to the masses. Now, we've seen it in training, right? Mm-hmm. With pilots, we see it in medical school. There are schools that have gotten rid of cadavers and they're now using VR and AR for students, medical students, to examine what a body is like. So we see it in those type of things. But if you're a single mother of two who's, you know, doing your day-to-day, getting your kids to school and stuff, where does this fit into your life, really?
Yeah.
It's not entertainment.
Yeah.
Right? So when we can think about the utilities of something and the value of something and the value that it actually brings to our lives, I think then we'd see it for the masses. But at this point, all we see a lot of is people doing filters, right? In both Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, right? You know, whatever people are using, we do see augmented reality used for those entertainment purposes, but we're not seeing a utility and value for our day-to-day life. Yet, I think there is opportunities there beyond what we have today.
I actually think there's this enormous opportunity in a world where we have a completely broken public school system. What was absolutely clear to me was that the pandemic uncovered. The pandemic wasn't the cause of things. It merely magnified the things that were already broken in a way that you could not ignore them anymore.
Right.
And I've always wondered that if we start to take a look at reducing the cost of the headset, because you're absolutely right, $200 headsets. I mean, we've been able to do it in laptops. We've been able to do it in phones. Whether or not this starts to become an interesting and viable solution of augmenting the way, I think first starting at the augmenting the way that we teach, right? But then more importantly, utilizing simulation to teach skills training, whether that's job, because I think profession specific is interesting, but to your point around play, right? And the research part of it and the experience with a low barrier, right? Experience history, right? In a way that is immersive, memorable, retainable. And for somebody like me who is dyslexic, by the way, where I have fundamentally believed that this technology, as a designer, would enable somebody who learns like me, right? Who learns very differently. I always look at my entire existence has been hacking text interfaces. Why? Because I struggle with translating text interfaces in my brain, right? That's right. The core of being dyslexic. And if you understand that, then you say, wait a minute, when we industrialized learning in the early 1900s, the printing presses, and because that is what the printing press helped us do. It knowledge sharing, right? Mm-hmm. How might we bring kinesthetic learning into this world and potentially re-enfranchise, you know, the 20% of the globe that we disenfranchised when we made text the only way to intake and ingest information.
Yeah. And yeah, they're great. I'm thinking right now about Kai XR. I don't know if you know Kai Fraser, but Kai Fraser is amazing. And she started a company using VR to take, you know, kids who were maybe in underserved areas on a trip using VR to places that they could not go previously. And also thinking about accessibility in mind, thinking about the disabled students who may not physically be able to go to these places too, right? So there is a lot of opportunity to use this technology to make, you know, to break down the barriers of entry to places and to experiences. And I think, you know, as I listen to you talk about education, one, for sure, we need education reform on so many levels. I have a dear friend who's been doing it for over 20 years, and I will just say it takes a long time to get that stuff done.
Yeah.
But at the same time, one of the approaches that I think about is universal design for learning, which you know, basically says there should be multiple means of engagement for students, because some people like to write, but some people like to draw. Some people like to do things from an audio perspective. They might write a song, right? They might write poetry. But the way that our education system has been is like, you do things one way and you don't do it that way. And, you know, I know so many people, and this is just an example from my class, when I say, okay, we're going to do a visual alphabet, right? We're going to draw things. And every single time I've taught this, which has been a bunch of times, students tell me I can't draw. Mm. And I say, well, who told you that? Mm-hmm. I said, listen, because I say, well, we're going to draw. And I know people start to say it, and then people will even say it low to themselves, I can't draw. And I said, somebody told so many of us when we were little,
yeah,
that we can't draw, that we started to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happens with so many things. Somebody tells you once that you can't do something, and then you start to believe it.
Yep.
And I said, listen, drawing is just a form of communication, and nearly everyone can do it. And it doesn't have to look a certain way. Because I said, you know, you can draw a straight line, you can make a squiggly line, you can make a circle. All of these things are forms of communication. Does a circle have to be perfect? No. I've never drawn a straight line in my life. Probably never will, unless I'm using a ruler. And so it's kind of, you know, in some ways getting out of our own heads and just doing the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. What are some of the ethical things that you think that we're not thinking enough about in human spatial computing?
Accessibility and people with disabilities. I consider, you know, accessibility an ethical issue. Our companies right now who are working on AR and VR considerate of folks with disabilities? I don't really think so. Not very much. So when thinking about, you know, someone who has low vision or someone who wears glasses, even sometimes these headsets themselves, with people who wear glasses, they can't put it on, right? Oftentimes, if somebody wears glasses, they don't really, you know, that's assistive technologies, right? Yeah. So I yeah. think that that's probably the biggest issue. I think also there's lots of privacy concerns around spatial computing and what could happen. But, you know, that we've already seen what could happen, and now we're allowing a device that could come into our homes, which could capture so many things about us, right? From our height to the way that we walk, to the way that we move, to the space that we live in. How much information do we want to be giving, right? And then there's the issue of children and what's happening or could happen within these worlds. Was the BBC a report of a person who had, you know, gone into a world, in a virtual world, and, you know, was harassed in this environment. And they were, you know, so there's all this stuff that we need to consider from an ethical perspective and from a privacy perspective as well.
Listeners, I encourage you to take Regine's message to heart and make a conscious effort to incorporate inclusive design principles in your own work. Together, I know we can create a world that works for everyone, everywhere, every day.